Title for this first conference is A General Introduction to Jungian Psychology. Jungian depth psychology is called analytical psychology by Jung himself. What we have here is only an hypothesis or a theory, that is, a working suggestion that attempts to understand certain objective realities that defy normal rational comprehension and explanation. We are dealing in depth psychology with realities that are not capable of explanation by ordinary traditional words and definitions. And so we are forced to fall back on symbolic words, which are meant to describe and express a meaning considerably more than the literal meaning of these words when considered from a earthly traditional point of view. In that sense, depth psychology is similar to the attempts of modern physicists to describe the reality of the atom and the composition of matter, which defies traditional images and understanding that we have had of the reality called matter. For Jung, we are dealing in depth psychology not with physical matter, but with spiritual realities, what he calls psychic realities, which are even more difficult to define than the atom, even more impossible to get a clear image or picture of them. And yet, they are just as real, in fact, more real than physical matter. We people of the Western world have been living in an age of rationalism for more than 2,000 years, dating back to the time of Socrates, Plato, and especially Aristotle, some 500 years before Christ. We took over this bias towards the senses and towards reason, the age of rationalism, and we developed it. It reached a certain height during the time of the Renaissance in the 14th and 15th centuries. And then Descartes, around the year 1600, is sort of the father of rationalism. In turn, it reached another peak during the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century. Finally, this age of rationalism came to its height during the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century and what we might call the Scientific Revolution in the first half of this century. Throughout these past 2,000 years of rationalism, the emphasis has been on the knowledge that we can gain either by means of the senses or through reason. And that is why it's called the Age of Rationalism. Jung insists that there are two other human faculties or functions besides the senses and thinking or intellect, and that these two other functions are intuition and feeling. He insists that intuition and feeling are capable of giving us valid insights into the truth just as truly as do the senses and our intellect. The two faculties of intuition and feeling operate in a way that is different from the senses and the intellect, and that are impossible to describe according to sensible images or intellectual categories or concepts. Yet, we must use these same sensible images and words and these same intellectual concepts in order to describe the insights into truth that come to us from intuition and feeling. And the only way to do this is to use these images, these words, and these concepts in a symbolic way. The opposite of symbolic is literal. The words and the concepts that we use to describe intuition, feeling, and all spiritual realities, all psychic realities, are never capable of fully expressing their meaning, therefore are never to be taken in a literal way, but only as pointers, signs or symbols point the way to a deeper understanding that defies adequate human expression in sensible images and intellectual categories. Jung insists that we must use all four human functions, senses, intellect, intuition, and feeling, in order to understand spiritual or psychic realities. But we need especially to activate our intuitive faculty and our feeling function, together with intellect and senses, and try then to bring these spiritual or psychic realities within the grasp of our human comprehension. This is the true meaning of a living symbol. It is perceiving and creating new insights into truth, into a reality that is beyond the physical, the reality that Jung calls psychic, or that more traditionally we call spiritual. A symbol is an expression of a spontaneous human experience which gives an insight and a deeper knowledge of something psychic or spiritual. Thus, a symbol always leads our comprehension beyond the literal, sensible, earthly meaning present in the external rational concepts or terms. It is a valid but limited human experience of something transcendental. And by transcendental, we mean that transcends. It goes beyond the earthly level, the physical or material level. Of course, there are many people in the world today and have been for the past couple of centuries who are pure materialists, who deny that there is any reality beyond what we can see and experience with our senses and know with our intellect. And here is where Jung differs from so many other psychologists. He insists that there are two worlds that we live in, and of the two, actually the spiritual world, the psychic world, is the more important, and is the one, of course, that we believe will continue to live after death, and therefore is immortal. It cannot be destroyed. It will live on and on. Hence the importance of learning all we can about this transcendental world of the psychic. This is where God, of course, dwells. This is where our soul, that part of our human nature that is like God, it belongs to this transcendental level. Some other transcendental values or realities would be truth, love, even life itself, goodness, justice. Teilhard de Chardin insisted that there is something spiritual or transcendental even in material reality, even in the hard rock or the mineral. And his theory was that that whole element of spirit within matter needs to be evolved and brought out so that it becomes more real and more conscious. And that is our task as human beings, is to lead out the spiritual from the material. It is most interesting to note that modern physicists, especially nuclear physicists, are saying very much the same things that Jung was saying 50 years ago. They are insisting that there is something more to matter than what you are able to comprehend with either the senses or the intellect. And so there is good reason to think that both of these sciences, the science of depth psychology or analytical psychology as Jung called it, and the science of nuclear physics, that these two sciences seem to be headed in the right direction and may very well merge. And the amazing thing is that they will merge in the very teaching that Christian people and other religious people of the world have been insisting upon for these countless centuries, namely that there is another reality besides the physical, besides the material, and that this spiritual reality or psychic reality is considerably more important than the physical. Both are important, but of the two, the psychic or spiritual comes first. The material and the physical exist for the sake of the spiritual rather than vice versa. According to Jung, the symbolic way of understanding these psychic or spiritual realities is the best possible expression for something that is still essentially unknown and unknowable, at least unknowable in a sensible intellectual way of knowing. Our present images are still theories or hypotheses which may at any time be replaced by other images, other theories, if they should be shown to be more suitable, more adequate to explain these psychic realities, these psychic or spiritual experiences that we have. And so all the terminology in depth psychology, as well as that in nuclear and quantum physics, is merely temporary and tentative. It's our present feeble efforts to explain something that's very real, but is still primarily mystery, is still more unknown than it is known. So sensible knowledge is the proper way to know sensible realities. Intellectual knowledge is the proper way to know intellectual concepts. Symbolic language is the proper way to know psychic, spiritual, transcendental realities, such as God, the soul, or the spirit, or psyche, or grace, or the self. The sensible images used in symbolic language are meant to be springboards or bridges, put us in contact with the inexpressible, imageless world of transcendental realities. Therefore, a good way to think of a symbol is a bridge which we throw across the abyss which separates physical, sensible reality from spiritual, psychic, transcendental reality. A good example of a symbol would be the water that is used in baptism. Water and the pouring of water, or the immersion into the baptismal font of the child, is a physical reality. It is something that is very sensible, that we can see and experience. But it is a way, a bridge, leading us over to a spiritual experience, a transcendental experience, which we call the Paschal Mystery. It is the means, in a symbolic way, by which we become united with the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Both nuclear physics and depth psychology are dealing with two worlds of tremendous energy. It is an energy that is still very unfathomable, very mysterious, very elementary. It has a terrifying potential, equally capable of destroying as well as helping us to a fuller way of life. In both of these sciences, there are two possible roads for us to follow. One is to stumble along and to make contact with these powerful forces, and the other is to take the time to try to understand them and then to find a way of using them so that they help us rather than destroy us. In both of these sciences, nuclear physics and depth psychology, we are dealing with cosmic forces. In other words, energies which are outside the normal laws and behavior of earthly material physical reality. After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we all realize the immense powers that are released with the breakup of the atom. If we are to survive as a people on Earth, we know that we have to learn how to use this new nuclear energy properly. In a similar way, modern psychology, like nuclear physics, has unlocked this powerful energy that lies buried in what is called the unconscious. These psychic, spiritual powers are now available to us. And just as we need to learn how to control nuclear energy, it is a matter of life and death that we learn how to use these new psychic powers that have been unleashed and discovered in our time. Hence the importance and the seriousness of learning to know all we can about depth psychology. Jung's theories concerning the unconscious, concerning the psyche, are not the only theories that have been presented to us in the past 50 or 100 years, but they are, in my opinion, the theories that best explain this new knowledge that we call depth psychology. The picture of the human nature that Jung gives us is that only about 20% of our nature is conscious, that the other 80% is below the level of consciousness, is what is called the unconscious. Now, if you could perhaps picture a circle and draw a line about 1/5 of the way down from the top, draw a line across the circle, that would represent consciousness. Now, in that particular part, that 1/5, 20% of our human nature, the center of that would be what is called the ego, the I, the conscious center of our being. This particular ego, this consciousness of oneself as separate from others, develops around the age of 2. This is when a small child begins to say I and know what it means. In addition to the ego, in that level of consciousness, the upper 20%, you would have these various faculties and functions. For example, all the different senses, the intellect, the will, the memory, the imagination, the feelings, the different emotions, everything of our life of which we are conscious. That would be up in that upper 20%. Now, below that line, the remaining 80% is very real and has a tremendous influence on us, and this is called the unconscious. It is out of this unconscious, for example, that our dreams speak to us each night. The center of the unconscious is what Jung calls the self or the person. As Christians, we would say that it is this self or person that is made to the image and likeness of God. This is where we are most God-like. In the Middle Ages, they spoke of that center of our being as the scintilla divina, the divine spark that has been implanted in the center of every human being. The ideal mature person is a person that has a very good relationship between the ego, the center of conscious life, and the self, which is the center of the unconscious and the center of the whole life. The relationship should be that of an executive officer, which would be the ego, and the general or the captain, the leader, the head. We are supposed to be governed primarily by that inner self. And the task of the ego is to make journeys into the depths of the unconscious and to make contact with the self, and under the guidance of the self, gradually to lead up into consciousness all of the material, all of the contents of the unconscious. We could say that everything in the unconscious wants to become conscious and needs to become conscious in order for it to become a part of our life, in order for us to live a whole life. However, we could also say that the contents of the unconscious are unlimited. They partake of the infinity of God Himself. We could never possibly exhaust all the potential energy that is there. Just as there is such unlimited energy when we break up the atom, that it's just beyond our comprehension. The same is true when we make contact with the contents of the unconscious. We are dealing with fantastic energies, unlimited power that can be used either for good or evil. The power that is present in the unconscious is what Jung calls undifferentiated energy. It is neither good nor bad. It is waiting to be put into consciousness. It's only when we bring it up into consciousness that we decide whether to use it in a practical way for good or whether we decide to use it for evil. Hitler, for example, made use of these psychic energies in an evil way. And it is our task, if we want to become mature, to bring these contents up into consciousness and use them in a practical, good way. If we fail to do this, there is a certain schedule, a certain rhythm to the way that the inner self wants to make conscious these inner powers. If we fail to live up to the particular destiny, the particular schedule that God has implanted in the depths of our being, these powers in the unconscious, they coalesce, it would seem, with certain evil influences, perhaps cosmic evil influences, and they erupt. And just as you have an atomic explosion that can do terrible damage, so when we fail to use this psychic energy properly, it can do just as great a damage to our life as in a material, physical way when you have an atomic explosion. Jung makes a distinction between the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. And here is one big area where he differed from Freud. Freud only thought of the unconscious as being personal. The personal unconscious contains all of those forgotten images and forgotten experiences of our past life. And that would include even the experiences we had in the womb of our mother, the experiences of infancy and childhood, as well as all the other things that have happened to us in our whole life that we have since forgotten, that are below the level of consciousness. And Freud, of course, discovered that many of the problems that people have result from these repressed experiences of childhood. And so in psychoanalysis, the task is to bring back to memory, bring back up into consciousness those forgotten memories and experiences that we did not properly handle earlier in life, especially in infancy. And what Freud and the psychoanalysts discovered was that in many instances, once these have been brought back into consciousness so that we are able to handle them in a proper way, then the problem goes away. But there is so much more to the unconscious than this personal unconscious. In fact, we might say the personal unconscious would represent about another 1/10 of the total contents. So the remaining 70% of our human life is what Jung calls the collective unconscious. The term that Jung uses to describe the contents of the collective unconscious is that of archetype. The archetypes are those points of psychic energy in the unconscious that we need to make contact with in order to become fully alive, in order to make use of these tremendous energies that are dwelling in our unconscious. So the archetypes are those sources of energy in the collective unconscious, beyond the realm of consciousness. They are neither good nor bad. They're undifferentiated energy. They can be used either for good or for evil. Now, the relationship between the symbol and the archetype, if you get the picture of the symbol as the bridge that we throw across the abyss between consciousness and unconsciousness, or between this physical material world and the psychic spiritual world, the foundation on which the bridge, the symbol, will rest in the unconscious is the archetype. So the symbols are the images and concepts we use to express the archetypes. The archetype is the point in the unconscious area of our life, the inner psyche, on which rests the bridge of the symbol. So archetypes are sources of psychic energy, sources of spiritual energy that dwell within our inner being, within the unconscious area. So an example of an archetype is God Himself. God is the greatest of the archetypes. But there are countless other archetypes. And in the second conference, we will talk about them and how we can bring them up into consciousness and make use of them in a practical way to help us live a fuller life. This is the end of the conference on General Introduction to Jungian Depth Psychology.